Okay, let me introduce a few things to you today to say to you this. You know me, I need to give you the context, okay? I could take a thing out of context and preach a fun sermon, but it just isn't who I am. So today, the first sheet of, you have the notes, the first sheet is the background, the backside is where we're really headed, but we have to set the background to do it. So all I say to you is don't get lost in the woods on the way through, because we're going to get there. It's like a smorgasbord. You eat what you can, and what you can't you leave behind, but we'll do what we can today. But just so you understand the setting, I need to give you the historical setting, the contextual setting, so you understand what we're going to the passage this morning. We have, the last few weeks, been looking at God's emphasis upon how important our families are. We saw that in 1 Timothy chapter 3. We saw it in 1 Timothy chapter 5. There's a few places where we see it as clear as we see it in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. I want to talk about the importance of the role of fathers and mothers in the life of God's church. It's so crucial. Having said that, I want to suggest to you this morning is a time of affirmation. You know, sometimes you walk out with a major guilt trip, but this is a time of affirmation. It's a time of confirmation. It's a time of encouragement. It's a time of reminder. So all of those things hopefully will be tied together in what we look at this morning in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. I remind you again, what we're looking for is what is the biblical principle that God would have us learn from this passage. And one can see what Paul says, but what is Paul saying to us in the context of all of this? What is the lesson that we are to learn from this? I remind you, cannot say it enough, the church is God's church. It isn't your church, it isn't my church. Even as we look at a body like this, we dare not get down to the place, this is our church. It's not ours, it's His. The day we think it's ours, we then think we can run it the way we want to, but it's God's church. And God rules His church. God and God alone rules His church. He does it through His God-inspired word. He does it through His God-gifted people. He does it through His God-ordained circumstances. I would say to you that this is not true of the church, it's true of your life. These are the three things I look at personally. These are the three things I look at corporately, continuously saying, God, what are you telling me? What are you telling me in your word? What are you telling me in the giftedness you've given to me? What are you telling me in the circumstances that you've brought into our lives? So God's gifted people are released. It doesn't mean you have to do it. It just means that we're free to use the gifts God's given to us in the context of God-ordained circumstances. And then leadership's job is not to rule the church or run the church. It's to make sure the church does not violate God's word. But our concern this morning is the first of these, and the first part of this, God's inspired word. Now, I want to get the setting here, because I want to do the setting of this passage, setting in Paul's ministry, setting in this epistle, by the way, the first epistle he ever wrote, setting in Paul's defense, the setting in defense of his action while present, and so forth. All of this is going to lead up so you understand the context in which this is found. Now, first of all, as you look at this, the setting of this passage in Paul's ministry. As we look at this, I just want to remind you again of God's sovereignty. You watch God doing things in your life as He brings circumstances in your life, and you might tend at times to complain, don't do it. This isn't man who did this, God did it, and we just need to forever rest in God's sovereignty. We remind that God uses even the evil acts of men to accomplish His divine purpose. You say, but it wasn't fair. I remember my wife one time, it was a very difficult time. We're driving down the freeway in Southern California. She is after prayer meeting on Wednesday night. She's in tears. And she says, it isn't fair. And I said to her, life isn't about fair. It just isn't. But it is about God's sovereignty. And so even in the context of evil men doing things to us, God uses these things to accomplish His own purpose, His divine purpose. So watch this. As you look at this, Paul's setting. And I'm going to show you Troas, Philippi, Amphipolis, Thessalonica. So watch this process. I mean, these are names, but look at this. Paul was on the way on the Ignatian Way. Ignatian Way is this major highway that led to Rome. And as they say, all roads lead to Rome, but this one, It went right down through Thessalonica, passed through Philippi, through Thessalonica, came right down to the Adriatic Sea. If you got in a boat and crossed over, you'd be in Brundisium, and in no time you'd be in Rome. Paul says over and over again, he longed to go to Rome very often. He planned to go, but God stopped him from going. This is one of the times. Now watch what happens. If Paul had kept going the way he's going, he ended up in Rome. But now as you look at this, it's a very interesting thing happens because God doesn't want him in Rome. God wants him in Corinth. Now it's so spectacular what God does. God has to get ready for him. So God has Claudius expel the Jews from Rome. And two of these Jews were Aquila and Priscilla. Now you know what's exciting with them. They got kicked out of Rome. And by the way, we're told in what happened at home, nobody tells because that's inconsequential in one sense. But what would happen is when they kicked you out like this, people would come through and just ransack your home. Never forget. The neighbor next door was having a fight with her husband many, many years ago. He was a plumber. Next thing you knew, all of his stuff was out in the front lawn. I've never seen the neighbors convert so fast in all your life. They were taking toilets away. In fact, the matter is, a few weeks later, we're seeing a toilet in somebody's front porch with a plant in it. It was amazing. But people converge when their stuff are free. And so here it was, the Jews have been kicked out. And so into the house you go. So when you go back, it's not like you have a locked house with all your furniture still there. It's gone. But these are people who are insightful. They realize that God could use them. While they were kicked out of Rome, they plant a church in Corinth. They then go plant a church in Ephesus. This is a lay couple. These aren't preachers. Tent makers. And then when they're allowed to go back to Rome, they go back to Rome again. So Paul writes them in his letter to Romans. But it's interesting because here was a couple that didn't say, what a terrible thing. They're used of God. Look at how they're used of God. They go to Rome. But God has them in Rome waiting for another tent maker, Paul, to show up. But God has to get him there. And it's interesting because here God was going to get him down there. So what God does, the one thing was, that when the Jews are leaving, some of them are going across the Ignatian Way. And they show up in Thessalonica and they say, Paul, you don't want to go to Rome. You just don't want to be there right now. So Paul says, if it's not that way, then I better go somewhere else. So he drops down. And it's interesting, this is the way it went. He went to Mysia. And he thought he'd like to go to Bithynia. He's going to move east like this. And God says, no, I don't want you there. Nothing wrong with Bithynia. By the way, you just think about this. If he'd gone that way, Asians would have been sending missionaries to us instead of we sending missionaries to them. But this is what happened. God says, no. So he goes to Troas. And you remember the story because this man from Macedonia calls to him and he ends up in Philippi. He loves Philippi. They love him. Read his letter. They just love with each other. But he kicks him out of there. In no time, he's kicked out of there and goes to Thessalonica. He gets to Thessalonica. He loves them. That's the people to whom this epistle is written. He's forced out of there. He goes to Berea. He's forced out of there. After a while, you get a complex, right? Now, I would think, okay, you're getting kicked out of everywhere, but hear me, God wants him to get down to Athens. He gets to Athens, a great place to preach. No, not a good reception there. So he goes, he sends Timothy back up to Thessalonica because he wants to make sure things are going well there, which means that he goes into Corinth alone. Paul was a strong man, but never liked to operate alone. So who am I going to operate with? I go to Corinth. I know nobody. I have nobody. I'm in this huge metropolis. What am I going to do? And here it is. God has somebody prepared. So he goes to Corinth. And by the way, Timothy then comes back to Corinth, and from there Paul writes his first epistle, the Epistle of Thessalonians that we have before us today. So when you think about this, you see, God sovereignly put him here. It's where it is, the setting of this passage. The setting in Paul's epistle. He writes this epistle. And by the way, look at 1 Thessalonians 3:6. Just an interesting thing you may not realize, but it's so crucial, this letter. But just now, and I'm going to say just now because that's what it is. Just now, Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us good news of your faith and love. Now, what's interesting, so in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, Timothy has just come back, 1 Thessalonians 3:6. But listen, what happened? He came back and he told Paul three things. He says, you need to be grateful. Think great things are happening in Thessalonica. So that's why the praise in chapter 1. He says, you know what? There are people making accusations against you. That's why the defense in chapters 2 and 3. He says, Paul, there are some questions they're asking. That's why the exhortation is chapter 4 and 5. All of this came out of Timothy's report from Thessalonica. But now look at the setting. I want to give you the setting. The first chapter is Thanksgiving, no doubt. It's all about Thanksgiving. The second chapter is about defense. The third chapter, the second two chapters, and then the last two chapters are an exhortation. But the second and third chapter we're looking is almost one half of the epistle is defending himself against charges against him. Boy, if you've been there before and people are saying stuff about you and you say, boy, this is depressing. You know, join up with Paul. He had a lot of this happening. And so for almost half of the first epistle he ever writes is defending himself against charges people are making against him. Now, in his defense, you know what the first accusation was in chapter 2? They were accusing him. They said, when you were here, your ministry wasn't even effective, and you know what, and you didn't even care for us. And then he says, after you left, you haven't cared for us. I mean, notice what happens. Go with me down in, it's just very fascinating in this section. As Paul is writing to them, it's interesting because notice in verse 17 of chapter 2, we brethren, having been bereft of you for a short while in person, not in spirit, we're all the more eager with great desire to see your face. We wanted to come to you, I, Paul, more than once, and yet Satan thwarted us. You know what? He said, you don't care. You left us and you didn't come back. Paul said, that's not true. I tried to come and tried to come and Satan stopped me from coming. By the way, just realize Satan's hand at work. But anyhow, Satan tried to stop me. So he said, what I did, I sent Timothy, chapter 3, the first part. I sent him down there to minister to you because I couldn't come. So you see these two defense. But the one we're looking at is his defense about his actions while he was with them. Let me take you there. In this defense, they questioned the impact of his ministry. Verses 1 and 2. For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain. There are people who say it was in vain. You know, it's interesting because it uses a perfect tense. And it's fascinating because in the perfect tense, it suggests an act that happened in the past and continuing results. He says, just look at the church. It's still there today. You know why it's there? Because the ministry God gave us. They questioned the morality of his ministry. Oh, it's amazing. You think about tough accusations. Verse 3, our exhortation does not come from error or impurity or by way of deceit. This is what people are saying. The man's dishonest. The man's impure. He says, not true. The third one, they questioned his motivation. Why did you come? All of this, by the way, just months after he was there. You know, it's so easy for us to look at Paul right now and we think, boy, life was this way for him. But you know what? It was tough. It was so tough. And when you have the very people who led to Christ being influenced by people, and it wasn't the majority. By the way, you know what they say? It takes no more than 7 people to split the biggest church. It doesn't take much. It was just a few people here. But boy, you know those people were vocal, they were vibrant and this kind of stuff, trying to create the discord. So Paul is answered just months after he left, he's doing these, answering these charges. And it's in this last one that we're dealing with. Okay, now, Paul defends his entrance. Paul defends his overall pattern of ministry. But then Paul defends his ministry while in Thessalonica. He says, let me talk about my ministry while I was there. That's the context in which this comes. Now, the interesting part, and this is in verses 5 to 12 where we are today. Now, what he does, and this is the whole setting of this. In verses 5 through 9 of chapter 2, notice what he says. For we never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor with pretext for greed. By the way, let me show you something, because I have it in your outlines, and it may help you to see something. Look in verse 1, you have the word for, beginning verse 1. Look at the word but in verse 2. See, the four introduces their accusations. The but introduces his reaction to their accusations. Verse 3 starts with four. And by the way, this is true in Greek as well in English. And he gives their accusation in verse 3. And then the but of verse 4 is his rejoinder. Then you come to the four in verse five is the accusation. And then notice when you come down to verse seven, but, see. You guys say my motivation is wrong, but let me tell you something. Let me tell you what I like in my ministry too. Although we had authority in verse six, we proved to be gentle among you like a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. And then notice if you go down to verse 10, you are witnesses and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blameless we behave toward you believers, just as you know how we are exhorting and encouraging, imploring each one of you as a father would his own children. You know what he says? He says, you know, I acted like a mother and I acted like a father. I want to stop here because I want to affirm you in the role that you have as parents. I cannot say it enough. I taught in seminary for 37 years. I make a comment because we as professors have an impact on students without a doubt. But I tell them in class, the greatest impact of your life in ministry is your home. It just is. Even, by the way, you say, well, in my case, I would say my home was unbelievably positive. And when I read down through here, this is my mother. This is my father. It is. Now, some of you didn't have a mother and a father who acted that way towards you. But hear me carefully. Even that has shaped you, and you know that. Because there are things that you saw, and you say, you know what? It's not going to be like that in the home that I have the privilege of being a part of. And so therefore, even those things reshape your life. But what is intriguing for Paul is that you see, it wasn't his marriage that he drew on because he wasn't married. It was his home. It was his upbringing, his father and his mother. And he went back and said, you know what shapes my life? You know what shapes my ministry? I watch my mother in the home. I watch my father in the home. And that's how I minister in the church. Just as a testimony of that, I've had people who have opinions about how I should do this or that because they shape it from the world in which we live. But I, even this last week, just reflecting on this, I sat at the feet of an unbelievably godly man and a godly leader, my father. And you know what? He taught me, and I'm not going to change what he taught me for what somebody else wants to substitute. It's not going to happen. He taught me about values. He taught me about principles. He taught me about the word. He taught me about prayer. He taught me about these things. And my ministry reflects my father. My ministry reflects my mother. It just does. And I'm back to this again. I cannot say it enough. See, when we function in the body of Christ, the family of God, we need to carry those things from the home into the church. This is not God's corporation. This is God's family. Now, it's in light of this, it's interesting because he says like a nursing mother. You know what? That takes one secure man, I got to tell you. You're in a church ministering and you're going to be the man, right? And you want people respecting what you have to say. To walk in like a nursing mother and provide leadership that way, that isn't what most men are willing to do. It takes a secure man to walk in there and to say, you know what? I'm going to provide leadership just like a nursing mother. And by the way, not just a mother, but a nursing mother tenderly caring for her child. That's how I was to you. So just to say to you, when you're functioning in the home, realize how important your home is to God's home. How important your family is to His family. What you do in your home prepares those whom you're raising to do well in his home or his family. And I'm back to it the other way. You watch so much of what's happening in the church today. Where do you think so much of this that's happening in the church that is not healthy, where do you think it came from? It came from homes. It came from parents who were compromising. They were not principle driven. They were pragmatically driven. It came from parents who wanted to people's applause rather than God's applause. Therefore, they changed their lives. Look at our country. Our problem is not with the president. It isn't with the Congress. Our problem is with Christians across this country. If we had been what we should have been over all these years, we wouldn't as a nation be where we are. We wouldn't be. Just finished reading Judges again yesterday. See, when the people don't turn their hearts to God, and back to the statement you do, if my people are called by my name, it's not if my leaders, if my people would humble themselves and pray. So I'm back to this, the impact of the home. Can I tell you enough in this we're going to look at today? The two things, the home provides a model. The model of a mother, then the model of a father, and we're going to look at those. Let me look at this. You see, when we talk about the home as a model, you know the role of the church. We're here to reaffirm the home, not to replace it. Seriously, hear me carefully. The church isn't here to raise your children. You're here to raise your children. That's not what a church is for. But we have let the church be there for that. You see, and I told people, you know, there are young guys. Some of them have never been married, or they just got married, and they've never raised a child in their life, and they're telling older couples in the church how they should be raising their kids. Really? And those parents are letting them replace them in the leadership of their children? No, don't do that. By the way, it's funny because I preach the greatest messages on kids and raising kids before I had any kids. Oh, were they good? Boy, now, this many years later, when I've had the kids and now the grandkids, a little more caution. Okay? Because you know what? You get to this, by the way, it is the job you enter into, the least prepared of any job you'll ever enter into your life. And even when it's all said and done, it's not like you sit down and say, I have all the answers. Oh, you just say, but by the grace of God, right? But here, back to this. So only say, we're not here, the church isn't here to replace the home, it's here to reaffirm. We complement, we don't compete. You know, it's amazing in Africa because we had nothing else happening. There wasn't church 7 nights a week. So every night we got together as a family. When I was growing up as a kid, we sang together, we read together, we prayed together. We got to America. My father had a terrible time having family devotions because church activities night after night after night. And stuff like this, it was hard to compete with the church in trying to raise your family. The church is not here to compete with the family. The church is here to complement the family. We're here to help the family be stronger. There's so many churches trying to make the church be stronger. You want to make the church stronger, make the family stronger. But if you make the church stronger and sacrifice the family in the process, you're making a grave mistake. So we're complementing, we don't compete. We supplement, we don't supplant. We build upon, we don't build away from. We build upon the family. That's why the family, that's why every family represented here, why it's so crucial. Most important thing you do is that. And when you're involved in ministry, it is a temptation. You get so involved in doing the work of ministry, you don't do the work of the raising of children. And then that's why you see so many difficulties with pastor children. The second thing we talked about before, just to remember you, home provides a model, the home provides a testing place. We saw that a couple weeks ago. The church is called God's house. Our homes are testing places. It says for a deacon, let him first be tested. He has to prove himself at home before you let him do anything of the church. And back to the great time, a man who I've had great time in leading churches with. When I first met him, he wasn't quite there. Came one day and he says, you know, he says, Pastor, we ought to have John be a leader in the church. And I said, so why should John be a leader of the church? He says, because he owns his own company. I says, and what in the world does that have to do with anything? You see, the issue isn't whether you can run a company. The issue is whether you can lead at home. And we do so much the other way. This is an accomplished person. We should put him in leadership. That's not where it is. Or this person has money, therefore, you know, that isn't the way it is. Failure in our home disqualifies us. Success in our home qualifies. It is. If you fail at home, you're not ready to lead in the church. So the church should focus on the home and be like the home. It just should. It's why, you know, in one sense, just say to you, when this body was started, it wasn't started primarily to be in a home as such. But I'm telling you, the closer to a home you begin, the closer to the Bible, the closer to the home you are, the closer to the Bible you're able to be. Why? Because you don't have all the other trappings that seem to surround. Okay. Understand the importance of your home because it is the testing place. understand your importance in the home. It isn't just how important you are. I tell you, this is affirmation time. You are important. You're crucial. Without you, it doesn't happen. The home or the church. Don't abdicate your leadership in your home. There was a lady. He took his wife to church. She got saved in his church. But then the pastor started trying to tell them how they should do everything. You know, whether you have a Christmas tree in your home is your business. And the wife said to me, I wouldn't care if we didn't have a Christmas tree. I just don't want some pastor telling me we don't have a Christmas tree. Let my husband tell me that if he wishes, but not some pastor, especially not when it's not written in Scripture. Now, here's the point, okay? There are so many times that we as parents or we as fathers, we abdicate our role of leadership. Don't do it. You are the leader. Don't let somebody else lead. Let somebody else dictate. May I tell you, don't leave your child for others to raise. Just don't do it. It's the school system. No, it's you. It's the church. No, it's you. See, the buck stops with me. There is no way to make it go to somebody else. It just isn't where it is. But here's the other. Don't feel pressure by others to do it their way. I've seen so many times in churches where parents will abdicate what they feel is right for the children because this is the peer pressure. This is what you ought to do. It's what everybody else does. It doesn't matter what everybody else does. It does matter what you feel led of God that you should do. So don't be in the, you know, your kids having no trouble with peer pressure. Don't make them have to put up with you being forced into things because of peer pressure. I'm back to it, and be principle driven, not pragmatically driven. So who sets the tone in your home? You do. Nobody else. And by the way, either way, even if you abdicate leadership, you're setting the tone in the home. Who is the best counselor for your home? You are. But we run everywhere else trying to get their help. Who do your children need the most? They need you. Who should make the decisions? You should make the decisions. Okay, specific message. I want to talk about being a mother. It's this amazing statement what he says here, just this amazing part, because I want to talk about manifesting gentleness instead of asserting authority. Here we go. Notice something he says in this passage. He says in chapter 2, although being able to be an authority as apostles of Christ, you know what? He had an apostolic authority. Now let me back off a bit, because I have no authority here. This is the only authority I have. You see, we have given pastors an authority they don't have. We've handed it to them. The only authority is God's word. Now hear me carefully. Back then they had apostolic authority. We don't have apostolic authority. I don't have apostolic authority. And yet you know what he did? Look at this. He didn't use his authority. Although we were able to be an authority as apostles of Christ, we became gentle in the midst of you, as if a nursing mother should cherish her own child. By the way, that is the reading you have, right? Yes, okay. You know what? It is interesting, because when you go from one side, see, hear me. Paul had authority. He didn't use it. Christ had authority. Christ didn't use it. See, you helped others. Take yourself down off the cross. Could he have done it? Yes. Did he do it? No. Did he walk around the disciples all the time saying, I'm in charge here? No, he put on the apron of a slave. He says, the Son of Man didn't come for you to minister to him, but for him to minister to you and to give his life a ransom. Listen, if Paul had an apostolic authority he didn't use, and Christ had a divine authority he didn't use, then you who have no authority, what are you doing trying to use authority you don't have, see? We somehow, even as, just think just for a while, husbands or parents, you say, we have authority. In a sense you do, but it's only God-given. But I'd say to you, be very, very careful, because you see, it's still servant leadership in the home. I saw my father provide servant leadership in the home, but I saw him provide servant leadership out of the home as well. It's where it is. So to understand this, he starts with this. Although I was able to be an authority as apostle of Christ, I became gentle in the midst of you, just like a nursing mother. Now, we assert an authority we don't have. It doesn't come from Paul's example. It doesn't come from Christ's example. It surely doesn't come from Scripture. It just doesn't. And then, by the way, may I go back to Ephesians 5, 22-33 in your mind? That's on the husband and wife and Christ and the church. The basic underlying paradigm there is Christ and the church. A husband is to function to his wife with his wife just like Christ functions with the church. So what did he do? He gave his life for the church. See, the whole point of it is we should be like he is and he was. And so what happens is when we assert this authority, we walk around saying, you know, you ought to submit to me. You see, when you do this, it isn't what Paul did. It isn't what Christ did. And they had the authority to exercise. We have no authority, yet we still assert authority for whatever reason. And when you can walk into a body of believers and you can function like a nursing mother instead of like a tyrannical, dictator, what an amazing difference it makes. But let me show you something else. So he does this. By the way, something that's interesting, this is just, let me go back to, like a mother cherishes her own child. This is what we call a customary presence. It customarily does. And that's true. You could find an odd... change the word. I don't mean it that way. You could find few mothers who do not exercise this kind of passionate care for their children, but very few of them. It is a natural, habitual tendency for a mother to function this way, and therefore Paul says, when I come to the church, that's how I function. I cared for you just like a mother will care for her nursing child. That's what I did, as tenderly and as carefully. By the way, when you think about that, when you take a child that's that young that you're caring for, how much more careful you are with that. And so notice what happens. He says, okay, now let me illustrate that for you. Thus, verse 8, being so kindly affectionate toward you, we were pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own souls because you were so beloved to us. Do you know what a mother does? Do you know what my mother did? Till the day she died, my mother was always there. You knew she was there for you. Always there. And you know, it's an interesting thing because when you think about this, see, they make the statement, see, man works from sun to sun, but woman's work is never done. Now, why is that? Because, you see, she cares for the children during the day, and then because her husband's going to have to go out work, and the next day she cares for the children during the night. And when you think about that, I go back to when our first child came home. It wasn't just during the day. It was the nighttime when she starts to cry. Her mother's out of bed to take her and bring her to bed, to feed her and to put her back to bed again. One of my students said, I made a deal with my wife because they were bottle feeding. He says, because I have to be at school all day and working all day, you get the baby during the daytime, but I take care of the baby at night. Well, that's okay. I said, but if you've got breastfeeding taking place, that doesn't work too well. Had a guy in the class, big, huge fellow, used to play line for the Los Angeles Rams. But he, huge, but such a teddy bear, such a tender heart. He says, my wife breastfeeds, I still do it when the baby cries. I go get the baby and come prop her up on my wife's breast, and then a few minutes later I change it to the other one. I think, oh my goodness, I don't get to go that far with this. Okay. Somewhere in there, both of you having to do a job that one could do just doesn't seem to work. But nevertheless, only to say to you, here is a mother doing this day and night, right? This is what a mother does. He says, therefore, when I was there, notice what he says. Go on. For you remember verse 9. How night and day, see, we work so as not to be a burden to any of you. See, I was just like a mother. By the way, it's interesting because it doesn't say throughout the day, throughout the night, nor does a mother, or she'd have a terrible time getting anything done because she'd be so tired. It's a genitive, which means it doesn't matter whether it's night kind of time or day kind of time, I was always there for you, just like my mother was always there for me. You know, that's what it is in ministry. By the way, this verse became such a key part to my ministry because, you see, it's not enough just to give people teaching. When I went and first started pastoring a church, I thought, you know, feed the people, feed the people. It's not enough just to feed the people. You have to give them not only the gospel, but also your own souls. My commitment over the years until very recently, as long as I was in ministry, the telephone was on my side of the bed. There's a reason. I wanted them to know it didn't matter what time of day or night they called, I was there for them. So, only to say to you, there is this, okay? You see, that's what a mother does. How a mother shows this is because she works night and day. But notice something else. And we minister, by the way, from delight, not from duty, because he says, because you were beloved to us. See, we don't do this because we have to. I've seen too many people in ministry, even elders. That's why even when Peter talks, 1 Peter 5, he tells elders to be careful. Don't do it because you have to. Don't ever provide leadership in the home or in the church because you have to. Do it because you want to. You love to. It isn't something you have to do. It's something you choose to do. Notice the next thing, if you will. It's interesting because you're beloved to us. It was an act of love. By the way, The reason he did it was so that he could express love, not so he could be loved. It's an important thing in the church and the home. Don't do actions in the home because you want to be loved. Do them because you do love. Now, I'll tell you what that's all about. You see, there are times if you're trying to be loved, and there are too many parents that are trying to be loved. And therefore, they're compromising the stands they should take because they want their children to love them. If you truly care for your children, you're going to do what's best for them. Not what they like the most, but what you know is best for them. And in essence, in time, they will know that you love them. My dear wife just cautioned me one time. She said, way back when, she says, but the girls, we think you don't love them. And I said, but it's not my primary concern to get them to love me. I must do what's best for them. And today, my two daughters dearly love me, but they knew what I did for them was, they didn't maybe know at the time, but they certainly know subsequently that whatever I've done for them over the years is out of love. Understand, do it because you love, not because you want to be loved. Say that to your husband as a wife, same way. Don't do it because you want to be loved, do it because you love. Give of yourself that way. Don't do it with some ulterior motive. You see, we're parents, not politicians. Politicians do it because they want you to like them. They want you to vote for them. That's not what a parent does. A parent doesn't compromise because he is. See, we are to be principally driven, not pragmatically driven. That's what it is. Be careful. So I did this, he says, because I loved you. Notice the next part. It's an interesting statement he makes. Notice this. He says, for you remember, brethren, our labor and hardship, night and day, working so as not to be a burden to any of you, we brought to you, proclaimed to you the gospel of God. You know what? Here's the other part to this, a more significant issue for Paul. You see, I didn't do because I wanted you to do for me. I did it because I wanted to give myself for you. Go with me to 2 Thessalonians 3. It's not that far away. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Interesting section there where, notice if you will, I'm starting verse 7. You yourselves know how you ought to follow our example. Notice, because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anybody's bread without paying for it, but with labor and hardship we kept working night and day so that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we not have the right to do this. See, it isn't about right or authority, but in order to offer ourselves as a model for you so that you might follow our examples. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order, if anyone will not work, neither let him eat. You know, I didn't come asking you to do for me. I came doing for you. It is a disturbing thing for me, watching men in ministry who think that people owe them something. They don't owe you anything. God is the one who provides for you, not they. And it's interesting because the if you watch your mother, see, a true mother, when she does it like this, she's not doing this for herself. She's doing it for others. Just read Proverbs 31 and see what the mother does. So, you see, is there not maybe a message for us in this day and age? No burden, see. It isn't, you're not here to burden somebody else. We're not here to try to run somebody's life. We're here to do for them, not to have them do for us. I take you back to 1 Peter 5. We've been there before, but listen. Peter says, put on the apron of a slave. Everybody, you come to church. Too many churches. Walk into church and think, you know, they're here to do for us. And we're back to it. It's like a restaurant, see? We go in there, we pay the money, we expect a good meal. If we don't get a good meal, we'll go to the restaurant down the street next time. It's simple. That's not what the church is about. You're not there and you see, so you think by giving your offering, that's your tip. You know, sometimes the offering is not much better than a tip. But see, the point of it is that's not what it's about. The issue isn't about that. The issue isn't going to get. The issue is going to give. When you came here today, see, the primary person coming here isn't to get. The primary person coming here is to give. If everybody came to church with that idea, not to be ministered to, but to minister, what a radical difference the church would find itself facing, right? It just would. So the question is, boy, you know, people didn't do much for me today. The question is, what did you do for them? See, as a mother does. A mother isn't saying, what can you do for me? I reflect back, and that's the difficulty. You look back and wish sometimes you step in to do something for your mother instead of having her bear this burden herself. But that's what she did, and that's what we did. We took advantage of what she gave to us, no doubt. Not because we willfully decided to do it, it's just because of the nature of what it was. But she was always doing for us, but she wasn't asking us to do for her. That's how it should be in the church. And Paul says, so I learned from my mother. When I came to the church, that's how I led the church. Let me take you to the next part. So as mothers, manifesting gentleness instead of asserting authority. As mothers, imparting our lives instead of just imparting the gospel. As mothers, providing for others instead of being a burden to others. So now, we said that the home provides a model for a mother and a father. So here we come. When you come to this, notice in chapter 2 now, he says, and I'm in verse 10, and I'll read 10 to 12. You are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave towards you believers, just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children, so that you may walk in a manner worthy of the one of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. Now, first of all, he had this relationship to the Thessalonian church. They were like family to him. But his relationship to Timothy is interesting because he calls him Timothy, my true child in the faith. Timothy, my beloved son. Timothy, my beloved and faithful child. But look at something else in Corinth when he writes in chapter 4. I do not write these things to shame you, but to admonish you as my beloved children. See, when he dealt with ministry, he saw it as not a pastor with the people, but a father with his children. See, that changes everything when you walk into a relationship and understand, okay, just like my father dealt with me, just as I deal with my children, so you carry this over to the church, and we understand that this is where it's going to be. Now, there are other references to this, but let me just give you this as a background, because he is a model as a father. He saw himself in that role. I functioned like a mother, I led like a mother, and I led like a father. And you see, I wasn't asserting authority. No. But now, let me talk to you about this. The church, we talked about this, see. The church is the testing place. And I bring this back to you again because here, we come to this, see. We certainly see how we should function as godly fathers and leaders in the church when we consider, you know, before going further, again, let's consider this. A couple matters first. We certainly see how we should function as godly fathers or leaders in the church. But we also see how we should function as godly fathers in our homes. This is both sides. He's dealing with the church here, but he shows us by how he dealt with the church how a father should deal with the home. And so both of them are here in a corresponding fashion. Okay, first of all, the message. Now, first of all, there are these four things. I want to look at them with you. And by the way, they're all crucial to what we do. Example, the principle is stated. Now, let me just cite these passages for you. In 1 Corinthians 4:11, he says, be imitators of me. Just that's all he says. In chapter 11, verse 1, he says, be imitators of me as I also am of Christ. See, when I say this, because I wrestled with it for years, I would have a hard time saying something, imitate me. But if you have a hard time saying that, my friend, you better change, because this is not just happened to be imitators. This has happened. This is intentional. You see, in a home as well as in a church, you understand a home. Children are influenced more by what they see you do than by what they hear you say to do. You say you shouldn't do this, but then you end up doing the same thing. They're watching you. They're watching you. The life is the issue. And you know it so often, you see. We become so uptight with our children sometimes over something they're doing, and the problem is when we stop and think about it, they're just doing like we do. And that's what bothers us so much. The primary role is as an example. And so he does this. And by the way, so I remind you again, it's not something that just happens to happen. It's something you intend for it to happen. Live your life so that others can imitate you. And if you cannot see, be an imitator of me, then make your life what it ought to be so that people can. Now, the principle is spelled out in verse 10. Now, it's interesting. Let me take you back to 1 Corinthians here. In Christ, as I became your father of the gospel, I exhort you, therefore, be imitators of me. Be imitators of me just as I am of Christ. This is intentional modeling. I am planning for you to do as I do. I'm back to this again. Look with me at 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Look at the statement that we just read a few minutes ago. Very, very important. He says, why did I do what I did? I'm in chapter 3. Notice in verse 9. I did this not because we don't have the right. We have the right. But in order to offer ourselves as an example for you, that you might follow our example. Why'd you do it? Because could I have eaten what you provided for me? I could have. But if I'd done that, there's some in the church who would have said, you know, Paul has just eaten off us. So I decided, you know what, I need to set an example, because I saw some people doing wrong and I wasn't going to be one of them. So he says, I did this on purpose. Now, it's interesting in this passage, it's spelled out. I love this because I'm back to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Look at this. He says, in this context, very interesting statement. He says, verse 10, you are witnesses and so is God. Boy, I like that. You see this in my life, but God sees this in my life. I share with someone, I was talking, we used to do a lot of conference ministry, my wife, myself, and we'd go, and I remember one clear example. We'd never been to churches before. We were up and went in Lethbridge, Alberta, which is just out of Calgary. We were there from Sunday to Wednesday. Then we left from there. We were another church up in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, from Thursday through Sunday. They'd never seen us before. We walked in there, and God just had a way of just unbelievably opening doors, making an impact on people's lives. You say, why didn't you keep doing this? Because we had a broad ministry this way and a very impactful ministry this way. You know why? Because you walk in there, they don't know you. You know, they almost think you can walk on water, okay? And then because you walk in there. But you see, in a church like this, you see our lives. That's why we commit ourselves to a local body of believers. Oh, we could have something that's more thrilling and stuff like that if we did it. But that's not where life is. See, you need a ministry where people observe you. But it's interesting because not only do you see this, but God sees this. See, none of you truly knows, not even my wife who knows me better than anybody, truly knows it's in my heart of hearts, but he does, right? So I tell you, when you start talking about accountability, don't be talking about human accountability so much. You can do that if you want to, but it's divine accountability. See, no human being knows what you're doing behind closed doors. They don't know that, but God does. When you can call God as your witness, I'm telling you, you've moved a long ways in your walk with God. Holily, righteously, and blamelessly we behaved in the presence or sight of you believers. That's what we did. So he says, first of all, I state this principle, I illustrate this principle, and now he says, I spell it out here in this context. Okay, now, empathy. The principle is stated. Notice one, verse 11, as each one of you knows. You know what? As a father, his own children. You know what? This is exciting because, you know, when I came to church, he says, I function just like a father would his child. Now, notice the point. It's in the context. But let me go back to... Well, let me do that. That's right. It's interesting because each of you... You know what a father does with regard to his children? They're all different. And you've got to treat them different. If there's anything that's a problem, we'll come to this in a moment. It's just it's an important thing. You can't deal with everybody as a category. I'll come back to that momentarily. So he says, what happened? He says, I treat you as a father. Notice the things I did. He says, and I want to take you somewhere because... Go with me to... Here's the principle. Go with me, if you will, to chapter 5 for a moment. In the same book. Chapter 5. I'm in verse 12. We request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over the Lord. Okay? And then verse 14. And we urge you, brethren, notice, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak. You know what? You know what you do to disorderly people? You admonish them. The next statement he makes in here, he says admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted. You know what the faint-hearted is? Literally a small soul. It's not found anywhere else. So we can't go somewhere else and compare it. But you know, we know what a big-souled person was. Somebody who's proud of himself, somebody who's got confidence. You know, you watch somebody who walks with a swagger because they really think they've got it together. There are a lot of Christians who don't have a swagger because they just don't think they have it together. You see somebody like that, don't you dare be admonishing them. Come alongside to comfort them. Then he says, you see a weak person, that's the next one. You see a weak person, notice what he says. He says, help the weak. Do you know what the word is? Let me find it for you because it's important here. In this passage, when he's dealing with this, he's talking about this. So he says, this is what I want you to do with each of these individuals. And he says, I want you with the weak. He says, the word is to anteko, to have yourself against. You know, they're down below us. They've planted some trees. They're still young. And they have them all staked. Why? So when the wind blows, the stakes are going to keep these plants from being blown over. When you look at people in the church, don't just look at categories. Say, well, so-and-so did the same thing as somebody else. It's not the same. This person did it because they were disorderly, because they were walking out of line. This person did it because they were small-souled, and they're just so insecure, and they need encouragement. This person did it because they're weak. See, look at people in the church same way you look at people in your home. Understand they're all different, and they must be treated differently. You admonish the unruly. You encourage or comfort the one who's small-souled. But when you find someone who's weak, you come and stake yourself next to them so that if they fall over, see, but they're not going to fall over. You're not going to let them fall over because they're going to pull you with them like that and you're going to hold them up, see. This is what you do. The principle is so important in the church because we don't deal with people as categories. Shouldn't. You can't deal with children that way. Can't deal with children that way. Never. I was reflecting on that this morning. I got called from the highway patrol one night and said, I have your daughter here. So it's late at night. I drive out there and the highway patrolman is standing waiting for me and he says, you're going to talk to me before you talk to her. He says, if you're going to get mad at her, I'm not going to let you see her. He says, because she did nothing wrong. She was on the freeway. She got a flat tire. There wasn't a spare. And there was a man stopped to help her. And that scares us because we're afraid of what a man might do to a girl by herself in the freeway. So I brought her in here to protect her. And I won't let you talk to her unless you promise me you won't get mad at her. You know what? You in your mind, you're driving there for 45 minutes with all kinds of ideas of why your daughter's at a highway patrolman's office, right? Are you with me? We categorize instead of dealing with individual situations. Be careful. Don't draw conclusions like this. It's unfair. It's unwise. It's wrong. So he says, that's what I did. He says, and I illustrate this in my life. But he applied this. You know what? Let me take you further. It's interesting because I'm going to keep going. You know, it's interesting part of this. You see, it's interesting part when you look at this. This is not an American concept. This is a biblical concept. America is be all you can be. The Bible is be all that God designed you to be. The American, don't restrict a person from doing as he wills. The Bible is don't restrict the spirit from doing as he wills. The Bible is the American, give man freedom to do and to be. The biblical thing is give the spirit the freedom to do and to be. So God says this. Okay, but now to the next part, encourage. The principle is illustrated, but I want you to see the spelling out of it. It's interesting. Look at these two words. You see the word, the Greek word has the word para alongside of it. Encouragement and comfort. You know the whole point of this? Come alongside. And he says, you know, I don't yell at my kids. I won't yell at people in the church. Never berate anybody publicly. Take them off to the side and talk to them side by side. That's what you do for your kids. That's what you do in the church. He says, so as a father, he says, I did this in the church because I made sure I came alongside of people. I exhorted them, but from alongside. I encouraged them from alongside. I comforted them, but I was alongside of them. See, I was always alongside. That's what a father does. A father comes alongside of his son or alongside of his daughter. That's what a father does. I must move on and show you this, but here, the exhortation. You know what? It's interesting because when he says in this context in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, he says, I did this as a father, notice if you will, exhorting, encouraging, imploring each one of you, so that you may walk in a manner worthy of the Lord who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. You know, this is not your authority. This is interesting. This is a God-ordained standard. See, the interesting part isn't trying to force your children to live up to your standards, it's trying to encourage them to live up to his standards. I'm not trying to tell you to do as I want you to do. I want you to do as he wants you to do. And that's where so much of the exhortation comes in. Always affirming, but always exhorting. By the way, this book is that way. It just says, if I could take you to 1 Thessalonians, but I can't. But just tell you something. Every time he deals with them, he affirms them first before he exhorts them. Come alongside of a child. Come alongside of your wife. Come alongside of your husband. Affirm them first before you ever exhort. Don't know what all my dad did. He would send me to my room and wait for 20 minutes before he'd show up. And I'm glad he waited that long because I'd hate to see what happened if he showed up right away because it was tough enough when he showed up 20 minutes later. I don't know all he did during those 20 minutes except I think the basic issue was to make sure that he would never come in a fit of temper to do any kind of discipline. But you know, when you think about discipline, if you decide to do that and make it wait 20 minutes or whatever, spend some time thinking of how you're going to affirm before you exhort. Because you know what? It isn't like they always do this. Stop and look at the affirmation part of it before there's the exhortation part. That's what Paul did throughout this entire book, and that's what he did as a father. The point. If we don't learn to be a scriptural and spiritual husband, father, we should be, we will never be the scriptural and spiritual leader of God's church we ought to be. It just won't happen. So we've seen the importance of models. Peter and Paul both tell us that the ultimate model is Christ. Christ left as an example, 1 Peter 2, 1 Philippians 2, let this mind be in you. We want to focus on him because here's the issue, you see. Christ was our model and we need to model ourselves after him so that others imitating us will imitate him. But may God help us, see, because to understand the importance of the home. See, this is where we learn how to do it so that we can carry it over the church. But this, when we learn to do it, we understand how important the home is. And I go back to this again. I sit and affirm this today. I look at my ministry. I look at my life. It is shaped by my mother, shaped by my father, more than any other two people on earth. And that can be for the good. It can also be for the bad. And so may God help us. Understanding God's pattern and priorities for ministry. Clear definition of priorities in this church. The importance of the role of fathers, mother, and life of God's church. May God help us to be the mothers and fathers we ought to be. Not only in our homes, but in the church of Jesus Christ. Just inside of that for a moment. When you watch somebody else's child who does something they should not do, and you know they shouldn't do, they know they shouldn't do it, everybody knows that. Don't start this criticism business. Come alongside the family and come alongside that child, because you need to deal with people in the church just like you deal with them in your home. And we can destroy lives because we don't come alongside as a nursing mother and as a loving father to care for people, to encourage them. Not only our own children, but other people's children as well.